The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mark Newman from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will share with you information from various medical sources. From the Wall Street Journal, hospitals address doctor burnout. Doctors who feel stressed or burned out are getting some urgent care. To address what experts view as a national epidemic of physician discontent, hospitals are expanding their C-suites with the new position of chief wellness officer. In recent years, hospitals have tried a variety of wellness programs, but there is a sense this approach didn't treat the causes of physician angst and alienation. Telling doctors to eat granola, do yoga, and be more resilient isn't going to address this problem, says Tate Schanefelt, who was appointed chief wellness officer of Stanford Healthcare a year ago. Instead, hospitals need to reform a system that has become debilitating to physicians and left patients vulnerable to medical errors and even malpractice, Dr. Schanefelt says. Other major medical centers, including Mount Sinai Health System in New York and the University of Alabama Birmingham Medicine in Birmingham, Alabama, have appointed chief wellness officers. Johns Hopkins Medicine in Baltimore hopes to hire one this year. In a discussion paper published last summer, the National Academy of Medicine noted that more than half of U.S. physicians exhibited signs of burnout, a syndrome marked by a high degree of emotional exhaustion and a low sense of personal accomplishment. The paper cited links between doctors' disaffection and the care they gave patients, with studies suggesting a significant effect on quality and risk of malpractice suits. To Antonio New, a vice chair of psychiatry at Mount Sinai, the preoccupation with wellness seems ill-placed. We all make a mistake by referring to wellness and not call it what it is, mental health. Dr. New says, physicians are exhibiting serious malaise, she adds, pointing to a spate of young physician trainee suicides in New York. What is crucial, Dr. New says, is making sure despairing doctors have access to treatment and therapy. Jonathan Ripp, a Mount Sinai internist, became chief wellness officer a couple of months ago and says that stress and burnout affect senior physicians as well as residents and medical students. One priority is reducing clerical duties. A leading cause of physician distress is electronic record keeping, which requires doctors to do clerical and billing work and cuts into time with patients. It has also increased pajama time, the hours doctors devote at home to electronic charting that wasn't finished during the day. Dr. Ripp says, one solution is having doctors dictate notes directly into electronic records. A related problem is managing electronic in baskets filled with patient demands. A typical physician nowadays gets bombarded with tasks, Dr. Ripp says. He envisions a team approach where doctors focus on clinical care and leave some tasks to others. By shaving administrative minutes here and there, Dr. Ripp aims to reduce nightly electronic work by an hour. Lauren Piccarola, a primary care physician at Sinai, says every night she spends between 1 hour and 90 minutes filling in patient charts or doing administrative work. This comes after a day of seeing patients, preparing dinner for her family, and making sure her three children go to bed. Late at night, she reviews patient notes and test results. I am not only typing, I am rethinking the whole case, she says. She recently became Dr. Ripp's deputy as Associate Dean for Faculty Well-Being and Resilience. Relieving doctors' clerical burdens also is a priority for Stanford's Dr. Schanefelt. Hiring staff to sit in on appointments and take notes is cost-effective, he says, because it frees up doctors to see more patients. Yet even that may not be enough to dispel burnout. Physicians have lost a sense of community and are feeling more alone than ever, he says. We are interviewing with our patients less. We are interacting with our colleagues less. We are becoming more isolated. As an example of frayed bonds, Dr. Schanefeld points out that the hospital's physician lounges, where doctors could meet, unwind, and discuss cases, have largely vanished. While two new Stanford hospitals have them, Dr. Schanefeld, associate dean at the Stanford School of Medicine, would like gathering places for doctors throughout his institution and at other hospitals to help drive community. I am pretty sure everyone has a room where they could offer bagels and coffee for parts of the day, he says. At his initiative, some departments have begun gathering small groups of doctors for dinner at local restaurants. Stanford pays for the food, but not alcohol, at the meals, where participants are encouraged to discuss topics such as life as a physician. In January, David Rogers, a pediatric surgeon, became chief wellness officer at UAB Medicine in Birmingham, Alabama. The facility has a physician dining room, Dr. Rogers says, but doctors say, we don't have time to have lunch. He lets doctors track their angst through a well-being index invented by the Mayo Clinic. It has a short quiz with questions such as, during the past month, have you worried that your work is hardening you emotionally? Also from the Wall Street Journal, the words that signal depression. Feeling down, pay attention to your language. Language changes significantly in both content and word choice in people who are depressed, according to a growing body of research using computer programs to analyze speech and writing. People who are depressed tend to use the pronoun I more, indicating a greater focus on self. They also use absolute words like must, completely, should, or always, reflecting an overly black or white outlook. Scientists have long known that people change how they speak when they are depressed. Their speech becomes lower, more monotone, and more labored, with more stops, starts, and pauses. But newer studies, including several published this year, have found differences in the actual words depressed people use. People who are depressed don't see subtleties, and we can see this in the words they use, says James W. Pennebaker, professor of psychology at the University of Texas at Austin, who studies how language relates to a person's psychological state. The study of computer-assisted language analysis for depression is still a nascent field, but apps and other technology that track language could eventually help doctors and patients identify a depressive episode more quickly. Since there are no biological markers for depression, as there are for cancer and other diseases, therapists currently have to rely on a patient's self-reported symptoms and on their own analysis to diagnose the disorder. Both can be highly subjective. The apparent suicides of designer Kate Spade and chef Anthony Bourdain recently underscore just how challenging it can be to identify and treat depression. In research published online in March in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, researchers at the universities of Arizona, Zurich, and Texas, as well as Michigan State and Georgia Southern, gave questionnaires designed to measure depression to more than 4,700 people at six labs in the United States and Germany. Participants were asked to write about their lives. The results, in addition to using more negative or sad words, people who are depressed use more first-person pronouns or I talk than people who are not. Pronouns show where a person is focusing attention, says Dr. Pennebaker, who is an author on the study. Someone who is really interested in another person will use the third person, he or she. Someone closely focused on a relationship will use we. But if you are thinking about yourself, if you are more self-conscious or self-aware, as depressed people are, you will use the first person singular, I or me, Dr. Pennebaker says. Depressed people also view the world in a concrete black or white way, using words such as must, completely, should, or always, that express absolutist thinking, as shown in recent studies published in Clinical Psychological Science. The researchers from the University of Reading in the United Kingdom use software to calculate the percentage of absolutist words used in messages by approximately 6,400 members of Internet forums for depression, anxiety, suicidal ideation, and a host of control forums. They found that approximately 1.5% of words used by people in the depression and anxiety forums were absolutist, which was 50% more than those used by people in the control forums. The percentage was even higher for people in the suicidal ideation forums, about 1.8%. Why are absolutist words so bad? People often don't realize they are using them, and they can amp up negative thoughts. Think about having your barbecue rained out. Saying, "This always happens," is a much harsher thought than, "Sometimes the weather is unpredictable in June." Absolutist words also require that the world correspond to your view. I must get that promotion. My children must behave. If the world doesn't adhere to what you demand of it, that is when depression and anxiety set in, says Muhammad Al-Masawi, a PhD candidate in psychology at the University of Reading and lead author on the studies. The more flexible you are, the better, he says. Psychologists say people can use language as a tool to help them reframe their thoughts. Very often, what you say is what you internalize, says Mr. Al-Mawi. Here are some tips. Number one, remember that the actual words you say matter, not just the thoughts they convey. Even if you are unable to replace negative words with positive ones, try replacing them with more accurate, neutral ones. Instead of, "This party is horrible," try, "This event is not for me." Second, banish absolutes, especially in relation to your goals or relationships, where falling short of your expectations can be particularly depressing. These words and phrases include always, never, nothing, must, every, totally, completely, constantly, entirely, all, definitely, full, and 100%. Replace them with nuance. Instead of, "I can never catch a break," try, "Sometimes things just don't work out." Three, write. Keep a journal. Try a stream of consciousness writing exercise. Compose an email to a friend. Then analyze what words you are using. Are they too negative or absolutist? All about you. Tweak those sentences and stay vigilant for those words in your speech. Four, ask a loved one to help you identify absolutist or negative words or sentences and suggest reframing. It is easier to notice someone else's language than our own. And finally, pay attention to your use of the word "I." If most of your sentences have "I" or "me" in them, you are probably too self-focused, says Dr. Pennebaker. Now from the Harvard Health Letter, Ask the Doctor, by Anthony Komaroff, MD, Editor-in-Chief. Why am I losing weight? I'm an 87-year-old man. Over the past year, I've lost considerable weight, and I didn't have that much to lose. My doctor can't find any reason for my weight loss and is advising me to eat ice cream, but isn't that risky for my heart? Answer, I smiled when I read your letter because I've occasionally said that if I were to develop a terminal condition, the silver lining on that cloud would be that I could finally eat all the hot fudge sundaes I wanted. Assuming that you've lost a significant amount, like 10% of your original weight, over the course of 6 to 12 months, your doctor was right to test you for various diseases that can cause weight loss. When weight loss is caused by a disease such as cancer or chronic infection, it's usually because the disease has reduced the person's appetite. One exception is an overactive thyroid or hyperthyroidism. That condition increases both appetite and weight loss. Fortunately, your doctor has found no evidence of a serious disease in you. If your weight loss continues, your doctor probably will repeat some of the tests. As for the ice cream, here's the way I'd think about it if I were you. At 87, you already outlived most men who were born the same year you were. On one hand, many decades of a diet that is high in saturated fats like ice cream does increase the risk for heart disease and stroke. On the other hand, if you don't have heart disease or past strokes, and if you have maintained a healthy diet most of your life, your risk from ice cream is low. So I recommend that you follow your doctor's advice. I would. Then again, I've already confessed to a weakness for ice cream. Can you get heart problems despite a healthy lifestyle? The answer, is it possible to have heart problems even if you live a healthy lifestyle, or to avoid heart problems even if you don't live a healthy lifestyle? Life contains no guarantees. Yes, even if you live a healthy lifestyle, you still can develop heart problems, particularly if you have been born with bad genes that make you vulnerable to heart disease. But even then, a healthy lifestyle does lower your risk of heart problems. And yes, there are people who live to 100 without heart disease despite an unhealthy lifestyle. Most likely, they had the luck to be born with good genes that protect them from heart disease. Since we don't know what all the good and bad genes are, nor how to change them, you need to do what you can to improve your odds, which is maintain that healthy lifestyle. 7 reasons why you may need a medication checkup. New medications and side effects warrant an evaluation. A medication regimen isn't something you can set and forget. You and your doctor need to keep tabs on what you're taking and how it's affecting your health. We are required to do a medication checkup at every visit, regardless of the specialty, which means that every clinician who sees you is supposed to review your medications and check off a box, says geriatrician Dr. Suzanne Salomon, an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. Sometimes things change between visits and adjustments need to be made. It's up to you to schedule an appointment. Here are 7 reasons why that may need to happen. Number 1, you take a lot of pills. It's estimated that more than a third of older adults take 5 or more prescription medications, over-the-counter drugs, or dietary supplements. If your regimen is too complicated or confusing, it increases the risk that you will forget to take your medicine and develop medical problems as a result, take too much of a particular medicine causing adverse effects, or have a dangerous drug interaction. Your doctor may be able to subtract a medication or a supplement to simplify your routine. Number 2, you're experiencing side effects. You might think to call your doctor about an obvious side effect such as nausea, but sometimes side effects such as drowsiness are chalked up to lifestyle. They may actually indicate that the dose of your medication needs adjustment. For example, taking 50 milligrams of a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, an SSRI for depression, may make you sleepy all day. Cutting back to 25 milligrams may control symptoms without causing drowsiness. Number 3, you're self-prescribing. Many medications that were once prescription-only are now available over-the-counter, such as the antihistamine Claritin or the heartburn medication Pepcid. When you take over-the-counter drugs without consulting your doctor, you may be risking an adverse interaction with your other medications. Number 4, you just got out of the hospital. If you receive new medications during your stay, it is important to see how they're working and if they need to be adjusted. We recommend a visit to the primary care physician within 2 weeks after discharge from the hospital, says Dr. Salomon. Number 5, you're seeing other doctors. Maybe you're a snowbird with doctors in other states, or maybe you're seeing a number of specialists in your own town. Patients often assume that their doctors all know what the other ones are doing, but we don't all share the same computers, Dr. Salomon points out. A cardiologist may change a blood pressure regimen, and the primary care physician may not know about it. Number 6, you don't need the drug anymore. If you're self-prescribing at the drugstore, or if your doctor has given you a prescription with refills but hasn't provided clear instructions about how long to take it, you may be taking a pill unnecessarily. For example, some medications like heartburn drugs, known as proton pump inhibitors, are not intended for long-term use. Number 7, your symptoms aren't controlled. Your doctor may start you on the lowest medication dose possible, but if you're still having symptoms, the dose may need to be increased. That's common with drugs for heart failure, such as diuretics or ACE inhibitors, or if you've been taking medication for a while and your symptoms are no longer controlled, that may indicate your condition has worsened and you need a stronger dose or a different drug. Tips for your drug checkup. consider a medication checkup a regular part of health maintenance. At the very least, medication should be checked once a year, plus after every hospitalization, says Dr. Salomon. And she advises that you bring all your medications in a bag to the doctor's office so the doctor can review them. A list is not sufficient, she says. People leave out medications or don't record the doses. Don't be afraid to ask questions about non-drug alternatives, cheaper medication options, drug interactions, side effects, and why you need each medication. Before leaving, ask for a printed list of your medications, especially if there are changes to the regimen. And remember, says Dr. Salomon, the list needs to be updated at each visit. The surprising side effects from using technology. Repetitive motion and poor posture can lead to aches and pains. You've mastered the art of texting, emailing, and web surfing on your smartphone and computer, but along with the digital prowess, you've picked up an unexpected side effect. We get a number of patients who develop injuries from these activities, says Dr. Tamara Rosenthal, an orthopedic surgeon who specializes in hand, wrist, and elbow disorders at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Hand pain. The repetitive motions of texting and typing can lead to general hand pain from underlying osteoarthritis, the wearing away of cartilage in the joints. Using these gadgets doesn't cause osteoarthritis, but if you're prone to it, it can increase your symptoms, she says. Using your thumbs too much to text can cause strain or overuse, injuries of the tendons that run from the wrist to the thumb, a condition called de Quervain's tenosynovitis. Symptoms include pain over the thumb, side of the wrist, which can appear gradually or suddenly, and move up the forearm. Pushing buttons too hard with your fingers can lead to inflammation around the tendons and pulleys that enable the fingers to bend, increasing the risk for trigger finger stenosing tenosynovitis. Symptoms include pain, popping, and a feeling that the digit is locking when you bend or straighten it. Hand numbness and tingling. It's not true that typing on a laptop or desktop keyboard will cause carpal tunnel syndrome, a condition in which the median nerve is compressed as it passes through a small area in the wrist known as the carpal tunnel. But Dr. Rosenthal notes that typing may bring out the symptoms of the condition, such as pain, tingling, and numbness in the thumb, index finger, middle finger, and inner half of the ring finger. Leaning too much on your elbows may worsen cubital tunnel syndrome, in which the ulnar nerve is compressed where it passes through the tissue near the elbow, called the cubital tunnel. Symptoms include pain, numbness, or tingling in the ring or little finger. Neck and back pain. Looking down at an electronic gadget for long periods can lead to neck and back pain. You're stretching the muscles, ligaments, and tendons in your neck and upper back, explains Dr. Andrew White, an orthopedic surgeon and co-director at the Spine Center at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. It's the posture and the amount of time in that posture that matters. Dr. White says this type of pain is temporary and won't cause permanent back or neck problems, but it's uncomfortable and it can also irritate the occipital nerve where the spine connects to the base of the skull, which can cause headaches, he explains. Hand and wrist fixes. Treatments for hand or wrist conditions include taking a break from the offending activity, splinting short-term use of over-the-counter painkillers such as ibuprofen or Advil or acetaminophen, Tylenol, exercises to treat the tendons, and sometimes steroid injections. You'll also have to modify the way you use electronic devices. If texting with your thumbs causes pain, you may need to use other fingers to text or use a stylus. If you have hand deformity or pain, use voice commands or use a fatter stylus to put less stress on the thumb joint. For more information about resolving hand pain, check out the Harvard Special Health Report, Healthy Hands, and that's at www.health.harvard.edu/HND. To ease carpal tunnel pain, set up your workstation so that your forearms are parallel to the floor, your wrists are straight and in line with your forearms, and your elbows relaxed and bent at 90-degree angle to your waist. Using a vertical mouse places the hand in a less stressful position, and keep the mouse in front of you, not to the side, suggests Dr. Rosenthal. Back and neck fixes. To relieve back and neck pain, adjust your posture when using a device. Keep your gaze parallel to the floor as opposed to downward. Dr. White suggests it's helpful to raise the computer monitor so it's level with your eyes. Do the same with handheld devices by propping them on a few pillows. More tips. Take frequent breaks and pay attention to discomfort. If you feel like you have a stiff neck, adjust your position, Dr. White advises. He also urges you to prevent pain by exercising and strengthening your core muscles, which support the spine. If you're physically fit, says Dr. White, it's been shown that you'll be less likely to develop neck or back pain. Simple fixes can make driving safer. Driving becomes challenging when you get older. Age-related health changes can make it hard to see at night, grip a steering wheel, or step on the brake in a moment's notice. Simple car tools such as a steering wheel cover that makes the wheel easier to grip can help. But research released in December 2017 from the AAA Foundation for Traffic Safety suggests that most older drivers aren't taking advantage of such tools. Between 2015 and 17, researchers asked about 33,000 older adults ages 65 to 79 about their use of adapted vehicle tools. About 9% of respondents said they had at least one such tool. Researchers also asked older drivers if their vehicles had factory-installed safety features, such as technology that alerts you to danger when you're about to change lanes. 57% said they had at least one of these technologies, but only 43% of that group reported using them. Even if your vehicle isn't equipped with high-tech safety features, adaptive vehicle tools can make driving safer, say researchers. If you're having trouble seeing over the dash, a seat cushion will give you a little height. There are also gadgets to bring pedals closer to you, put dashboard buttons on the steering wheel, and provide support for aching backs or arms. An occupational therapist can help determine which tools might help you, where to get them, and how to have them installed by a trained technician. So next week, we're going to review salad greens, getting the most bang for the bite. And can this DNA test help predict your longevity? And digital health tracking. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mark Newman, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138 and stay healthy.